Good morning and welcome everyone to this first seminar after midsummer and maybe the last of a year. Nice to see all of you here for this discussion of the impact evaluation method of qualitative comparative analysis. My name is Kim Fors and I'm one of the members of the expert group for aid evaluation, which is a government committee for aid policy studies and aid evaluation. I think many of you know about us and I recognize many persons around the table, but let me still say a few words for those of you who haven't been in contact with us before. The committee has been in existence for 3 years now. We're on our third year and we have a mandate now up to through 2018. And it's a committee consisting of 10 members of the committee, and then we have a secretariat of 7 people who make things happen, and we in the committee work more with the ideas of what to do, and we also approve the studies that are published for us. That's briefly our mandate and our division of labor within the system. This committee is the fourth of its kind of how the government organizes independent evaluation. The first such entity was created in 1991, which was called SASTA, and it was also a committee that was closed in 1995. And then there was an internal working group in the Ministry for Foreign Affairs for a number of years, EGDI. And after that, the independent organization SAREV was created, which was in Karlstad, and that lived for 6 years. And then we were created after that. So that's very briefly the history of independent evaluation in development cooperation. And of course, there is such a tradition in most policy fields in Sweden, though that actual history looks different in different policy fields. Maybe more turbulent in aid than in many others, but still that's the way it is. So what we do is various kinds of studies of aid impact and the aid development cooperation processes. We have now commissioned and published around 20 studies, and we have another 20 roughly, a little bit less in the pipeline. And they are thematic overviews. They are reviews of organizations, like we have had one study of the African Development Bank. We have done reviews of the effectiveness of aid and impact of aid in different sectors, like in health, education, climate change. And we have done other, so to say, policy-related studies on the 1% target, etc. We have now ongoing a number of country studies. One of the experiences and impact of 50 years of development cooperation in Tanzania. We have another country study of Uganda, one study of regional cooperation in Africa. They will be published at the seminar in September. So September or October. Anyway, after the vacation. So when you have had your vacations and are back and want another seminar, we will be there for you in the autumn. But apart from these studies, we have also done a number of studies on evaluation methods. The first study we ever did was on randomized control trials. But we thought after that we need to balance that and also bring in other methodological approaches to impact evaluation, and there are many. But one of the most exciting ones, and one relatively new one in the field of development cooperation, is qualitative comparative analysis. And that's then our most recent methodological study. And for that, we have had the good luck of having Barbara Befani write the study for us. And Barbara is one of the foremost experts in the world, in Europe, definitely in Sweden, on the subject, in Stockholm, yes, here. So we are very glad that you have done this study for us and that you are here to introduce it. First, a general overview and then a more detailed session on how to actually work with a study. But the report is not only a handbook on how to work with the method of qualitative comparative analysis, but it also aims to set it into perspective and say when it is good to use and when it is not so good to use, what its strengths and weaknesses are. So we also take a little bit of a perspective on what people who commission evaluation need to know about the method. Hence, after Barbara's introduction, we will have some comments from Katarina Perol from SIDA, who has had a long career there, working with water resources, environmental areas as a project program manager, and then most recently you have been 3 years with the monitoring and evaluation unit, as a deputy chief presently, and then we have Rick Davis with us. Rick Davis is also from Britain, like Barbara. Glad to have you here in spite of the events in recent days. And again, both Rick is from Australia and Barbara from Italy, so the kind of typical British persons nowadays. Yeah, sort of. Glad to have you here, Rick. And Rick, apart from being everywhere in the evaluation debate and contributing to that in different perspectives, I think you probably have had a focus on methods of impact development, but of course on also on many other issues, quality assurance, etc. Rick runs the website called Mandy, Monitoring and Evaluation Mandy, which is probably the best free resource on evaluation issues that there is in the world. So we're very glad to have you here also. So the program of the day is that we start with Barbara introducing the study. I forgot to introduce you. It's so obvious, Barbara is primarily an independent consultant, but she also has had various affiliations with university establishments in the UK, primarily now with the University of East Anglia Glad to have you here, Barbara. So we start with Barbara introducing the study. And then we will have comments from Katarina and from Rick, and then we have a coffee break. After the coffee break, we have a breakout sessions, and the one will focus on the steps in how to do the work with the qualitative comparative analysis, and that will be the rest of the morning up to lunch, and then it will continue after lunch. And there will be another shorter one led by Rick on what you need to think of when you commission evaluations using QCA, and of course considering whether you should use QCA or not. Barbara, over to you.
Okay. I was thinking another reason why it's good to have Rick here is that we've been discussing this method for many years, and as soon as he discovered it, he was very interested in it, and he started comparing it to other methods that he knew, and he was like, oh, this is similar to this, but a little different. So I think he has a good overview of like similar methods, so that's, I think, an additional, which is not something that many people have, so it's an additional reason why it's good to have him here. I need to change the slide. Is it? So I've prepared a short half an hour presentation about the report. Okay, but instead of going like chapter by chapter, I just want to give you an overview of the report first, of the contents, and then go a little bit in more detail into the structure. So, why are we here? We're talking about methods, and recently there has been a push for rigorous evaluation methods, in particular impact evaluation methods. And the idea is to look for methods that are rigorous and appropriate, both rigorous and appropriate. But at the same time, historically, there's been a supremacy of methods based on counterfactual analysis, and in particular on randomized control trials, which present a number of problems. There's a very old list of internal validity threats to randomized control trials. But there are also issues of external validity, because they are only able to understand, to answer a limited number of questions. And it's hard to generalize the results of randomized control trials unless very specific circumstances apply. Then obviously there are, as all other quantitative methods, there are issues of construct validity. not to mention problems with reconstructing counterfactuals. So essentially, on one hand, there is this push from development agencies for rigorous methods. On the other hand, on the supply side, there is this very much kind of monochromatic offer of counterfactual methods, which have a number of problems. So there's sort of a mismatch between demand and supply. And what I've been working on in the last 5 or 6 years now is innovative methods for impact evaluation. So try to understand, not to invent methods from scratch, but trying to understand what is out there, what is being used in social science and academia and practice in other fields, and try to see if these methods could be useful for evaluation, and in particular for development evaluations. One of the issues that this debate has focused on is causal questions, because impact evaluation is about attributing effects to the intervention. So understanding how much the interventions are responsible for the outcomes. This can be done in a number of ways, but the prevalent discourse has been that in order to establish causality, you need a counterfactual. I still remember, like, I was, I think it was like 2011. It was the first year I've moved to the UK, and I was at this debate at the London School of Economics with Howard White and Nancy Cartwright. It was more of a fight than a debate, but I remember at some point Howard White very proudly stated, "You can't establish causality unless you have a counterfactual," and that is plain wrong. I mean, it's just wrong. And if you look at what scientists do, not to mention I mean, let's not even go into what professionals do and how professionals attribute causality. But even in science, there are four, depending on sort of how you cut, there are different ways to cut the cake, but for sure there are multiple ways to establish causality. And this is something that is addressed in the study that Kim and I worked together with Elliot Stern in 2012. Ah, yes, Enrique. So you have like half of the core team of that study here. So these three... these three methods, which are dealt with in the Annex A of this report, are Smith's methods, generative causality, and configurational causality. And they also have alternative names. I probably don't have time to go into much details, but we can do this later. So... one of the ways that this debate has evolved is around considering a diverse range of methods. And in particular, obviously, when you have multiple options, then the problem becomes, great, I have multiple options, but how do I select methods? How do I know which methods are appropriate under different circumstances? So one of the idea that was advanced first in this report that I just mentioned was that of the design triangle. So the design triangle means that it's a triangle because there are three elements. On one hand, the available methods, then the different causal questions that can be answered, and then the characteristics of programs. And the idea is that methodological choice, methods needs to be aligned with questions and with characteristics of programs. So not all methods answer all types of questions. Not all methods are feasible in all programs. So once you know the characteristics of your programs and of the evaluation process, once you know what questions you're interested in answering, then you can choose the most appropriate methods for these circumstances. So in this context, QCA, which stands for Qualitative Comparative Analysis, is one of many potentially interesting methods, and is currently raising a lot of interest, and it's being tested and applied in an increasingly high number of evaluations. But it's not appropriate for all circumstances. So in this sense, it's not a method which is like superior to other methods. One of the things that you can often find in this counterfactual evaluation debates is hierarchies and scales. I remember the Magenta book. How many of you have heard of the Magenta book? It's the official evaluation methodology sorts of the British government. And there's an annex on impact evaluation with a very nice ranking of methods by rigor. So it's like, do randomized control trial first. If you cannot do randomized control trials, then do quasi-experiments. If you cannot do quasi-experiments, then go for mixed methods. If you cannot do anything quantitative, yes, then we're fine with qualitative methods, but they're like really the bottom of the... They're down in the gutter, essentially. So this is not... You know, the logic that we're using has nothing to do with that. So we are... working with this design triangle idea in mind, and QCA is appropriate in some circumstances, it's not appropriate in other circumstances, just like any other method. Okay, so why... when is QCA appropriate and when is it useful? When it was initially developed, this started around 1987. I mean, the algorithm was used in engineering, but then the first application to social science date, I think, 1987. So initially, the first few years after the seminal book, the author of which is Charles Regan, an American scholar, social scientist, it was seen as a sort of the only available method, the only option for the no man's land. What is the no man's land? The no man's land is like when you have 5 to 30 cases, which are like too many cases for case studies and too few cases for statistical analysis. So what do you do? We do QCA. That was one of the ways that it was kind of promoted. But then, with time, people are starting to realize that it's so much more than that. So first of all, the upper limit doesn't hold anymore. So you can use it on 100 cases and more. Then it's a qualitative method because it works with qualitative constructs and concepts. But at the same time, it's a method for generalization, and it's used to synthesize information covering multiple cases, as we said, even 50 cases or 100 cases. So in a way, it's kind of its ambition is to take the best of both worlds, you know, both quantitative methods and qualitative methods. So it's a qualitative method, but at the same time, it's rigorous because it's based on mathematics. It's based on algorithms, so it's replicable, and this obviously allows for internal validity because, given the same circumstances, different people can just run the same algorithm and get to the same findings. But the thing is that the mathematics that it's based on, that's why it's a bit of a completely different world from the methods that we know, because the mathematical base is completely different. So it's not calculus, like statistics are based on calculus. The mathematics that underpins QCA is set theory and mathematical logic. So why is that different? How much time do I have? 10 minutes? 15 minutes, okay, good. So calculus is about covariations and the models that you see, for example, in regression analysis, and this is something I look at in Annex B. Models are like mathematical functions, and they use, like, first of all, they use real numbers, so like 0.357891010, etc. So it's a very, very precise numbers, and they use the operations like addition, multiplication, subtraction. So they are kind of models that you use to represent. That's the idea that we have of quantitative methods. That's not the kind of thing that QCA is about. QCA is based on set theory, and set theory is about sets. Sets are like collections of objects they can be any object, any kinds of object, any sorts of objects. That's why we call it qualitative, because these objects can be qualitative and described as with qualitative constructs. And the operations used are union, intersection, and negation of sets. And we'll see this later, what this means. So it's a completely different word. Like the intellectual mathematical base is completely different. And we see what are the implications of this. So one of the things that makes QCA different compared to other methods is the kind of causal model that it's based on. So, for example, with regression analysis, we focus on the contribution of a single variable. We focus on the contribution of a single variable to an outcome. And we describe it in terms of a proportional increase. So it's like, the more this increases, then the more that increases. So it's about like, we're running out of something and we're topping up something with this one variable. So that's a very specific way of conceptualizing the contribution of something to an outcome. Then we have the sort of mechanism-based way, generative ways of describing causal links, which is more like describing in detail how the causal transformation happens. So sort of going to the inner workings of the mechanism. It's like opening. So this is also known as kind of opening the black box. But then with the kind of causality that QCA is based on, so the set theory, configurational-like type of causality, what we do is like we capture the complexity of events and the way that different factors combined unexpectedly. It's the same kind of causality that used in chemistry. So in chemistry, the same elements can have completely different reactions depending on which other elements they're combined with. And this is useful for us because in development and in many other policy sectors, if you do the same thing in different contexts, it can have completely different consequences depending on what other things are happening at the same time, depending on the history of the place, depending on the institutional conjunctural situation, on the political situation. So there are so many factors that are, and it's usually unpredictable. It's very hard to predict the outcome and to understand how these factors combine. And this is what QCA allows you to map. It allows you to map all these factors and the consequences and understand what are the patterns and the pathways to positive or negative outcomes. So the causal question becomes knowing that the same causal factor, which can be, for example, an intervention, works differently under different contexts. Then the causal question becomes, what's the role of given factors in different contexts? So it's not about concomitant variation, which is one of Mill's methods, or the average role, the average weight that a factor has, because this role can be very different in different contexts. And what works is not a single factor, at least not in general. So what we're looking for is specific combinations or recipes or packages of factors. And we want to understand regularities, but regularities not so much of single conditions, but more of like packages and combinations. And we want to create typologies. So we work in a sort of middle range kind of approach. What's middle range approach? In sociology, this term is used to sort of distinguish, to say that you're not looking at single case, which are peculiar, which are different from anything else, but you're also not working on the entire population, and you're not looking at something that is equal in the whole population. You're working on a sort of middle range of similar cases, but you still have different types of cases. So it's more like you have different types of cases, and every type is not just one case, it's a number of cases. So it's like you have types of cases, each type covering a small number of cases, and then you have a limited number of types. So that's the kind of level that we work on with QCA, which again is very useful. One of the reasons I became interested in QCA is when I was working on EU policy. And at the time, there were a lot of evaluations that were commissioned. They were like EU-wide, so they were trying to understand and compare what was happening across European countries. At the time, I think it was 25 or maybe 23. I don't remember exactly, but it was still small N. It was medium N, at least. So it wasn't something that you could easily handle with statistical methods, provided that it made sense to handle it with statistical methods. But it was still kind of difficult to say something EU-wide that, you know, using just case studies, because it's like you had to compare 20 objects. So QCA seemed something like perfect for this kind of studies. Another interesting, I would say extremely interesting opportunity that is offered with QCA is that QCA takes the notions of necessity and sufficiency very seriously. Sometimes, in regression analysis, and sometimes even like with mechanism-based causality, when we talk about causal links, we don't necessarily say we're talking about causal necessity or causal sufficiency or both. But actually, this is a very meaningful distinction because there's a big difference between something that is necessary but not sufficient, or something that is sufficient but not necessary. So what does this actually mean? It means that sometimes what you do with your intervention, and when it's combined with a number of other things, it can be kind of it's a good recipe. So it's like good enough. It's good enough for the outcome. And if you repeat that, if you sort of repeat the same magic formula at other times and at other places, it's still good enough for the outcome. But it's not necessary. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's also necessary. So it's like there can be other ways that you can achieve the outcome. And this is kind of almost obviously true in development corporations. Like there are situations where the outcomes are achieved without interventions. So what is the added value of interventions, and are the interventions needed in specific times and places or not? Because it's obviously not the only way to improve education. I mean, there are other ways to do it. And if you can argue this at different levels, like you can say, well, other types of policies are more effective, or you can say other types of intervention within the same policies are more effective. But it's very hard to argue that there was no other possible way that you can achieve an outcome except doing your intervention in the way that you did it. So it's a very strong argument to make. So that's why it's important to take this fact into account, that there can be other ways to do it. So which doesn't mean that your intervention is useless, because it can be sufficient to do it, but not necessary. So it's just a way to sort of make the argument a bit more sophisticated. At the same time, another good argument that you can make about your intervention is that it's necessary. So there's no way that you're going to get there unless you do something. But it might not be enough. So that's why it needs to be combined with maybe a favorable context or other factors. So by itself is not enough, which doesn't mean that it's bad, because if you don't do it, that there's no way you're going to achieve the outcome. So again, it's a way of kind of making the causal arguments a little bit more more sophisticated, and you can make these arguments with QCA very clearly. So, what are the question answered by QCA? You remember at the beginning we said QCA is not good for everything, it's not good every time. And in particular, it's not necessarily good to answer all sorts of questions. So, for example, you have a very popular question in impact evaluation is the questions around the net effect. So what would have happened without the intervention? Or what is the additional contribution that the intervention makes to this outcome, like in quantitative terms, the net effect? This is not something that QCA is useful for. It's just not appropriate for that. It's also not appropriate to understand mechanisms in depth, which doesn't mean that it's incompatible with this kind of approach. Actually, it needs to be combined with generative interpretive approaches to explain outcomes. But it doesn't do it in itself, so it's not something that you can use QCA by itself for. So the questions that it's helpful for are the following. What works for whom? Under what circumstances? So it kind of maps the diverse ways of working that an intervention has. And then what makes a difference for the outcome where? Because your intervention doesn't work in the same way across all contexts. And in some contexts, it makes a difference. In other contexts, it doesn't. So it's not the question you're trying to ask is like, did my intervention make a difference in general? But you're trying to see where it made a difference, where it worked and where it didn't work. Then what conditions are conducive to the outcome? What conditions facilitate the achievement of the outcome? What conditions prevents the outcome from materializing? And then the necessity question is what conditions are required for the outcome to materialize? So in general, I guess you can kind of say that one of the overarching questions is which pathways, combinations, recipes consistently work and which don't. Then when we discuss the appropriateness, we mentioned that it's not just about what the methods can do, but it's also if they can be applied in your specific case. Because evaluation processes are very different, interventions are very different, so not every method can be applied. And this is kind of obvious. I mean, we wouldn't be sometimes I think if RCTs were applicable to every kind of interventions, you know, I would be unemployed. I would be doing something else. But so when can QCA be applied and when it can't be applied? So there are a number of requirements. In my view, even though maybe this is not strictly a requirement, but it's more like a trivial. Like if you don't meet this requirement, then QCA becomes sort of a trivial exercise. So you can still do it, but it's not like as helpful as it could be. So I think you need to have at least 3 to 5 cases. Like if you have 1 or 2 cases, yes, you can sort of still describe cases in that way, but it just still doesn't add much value. So I think you need to have at least 4 or 5 cases to apply it. But the trickiest requirement is comparability of these cases. So these cases need to be comparable. And this is often one of the obstacles to using QCH, not finding comparable cases. We will see later what comparability means. Then you need a sense maker, because QCA configurations, and we will also see this later, are essentially strange words. They're made of like strange words and symbols and sometimes numbers. So you need someone to kind of interpret these things and make theoretical sense of these things and kind of explain the mechanisms that underlie the configurations. And this need usually it's like the principal investigator of the of the evaluation of the research. It's an expert of a substantive field. But at the same time, they have to have a technical knowledge of QCA if they are to use it. So another thing you need... 2 minutes? Okay, so five, okay. So another thing you need is conceptual knowledge of the method. So, for example, the ability to understand set theory, necessity and sufficiency, but also technical skills for the software. And what I recommend in the guide is that at least three software platforms are used, because like software platforms for QCA are different. They have different strengths and weaknesses. So, because the history of QCA is a bit complicated, like there are many people working on it, and they use different terminology sometimes. So we don't have like one package that does everything great. So we have to use different types of packages. So I think, you know, this is something that takes a while to learn, right? And this is something that you need. But as I was saying, let's talk a little bit more about comparability. Sorry, just let me check how many slides I have. Oh, okay. Yeah, I should be able to. So what is comparability? So, I mean, it's tricky because in QCA, case-based information needs to be converted into numerical values at some point. And it's not real numbers. It's not like 0.125678, but it's a scale. And in vast majority of cases, it's either a 2-point scale, a 4-point scale, or a 6-point scale. In the most popular version of QCA, it's usually a 2-point scale. So it would be something like presence or absence or 0 or 1. It's like, it's this construct there or not? Like, is this country high income or not? Something like that. Well, income is it's a hard, best possible condition I could pick, but anyway. So this process is known as calibration. So you have to create rubrics, define what presence means, what absence means, like all the degrees of membership to this construct that you can use to score the cases. And this needs to be consistent across the cases for internal validity reasons. So the same rubrics, the same translation method need to be used for all the cases. And sometimes it's tricky to describe information about the case in this way, sort of to describe information in terms of presence and absence of something. But there's a lot of discussion around this in the report in chapter 2. So what is the report about? So the report is divided into three chapters. And there are three annexes. So chapter 1 covers a lot of things that we've been talking about today. So this idea of appropriateness and methodological choice, and sort of positions QCA in a sort of landscape where many other methods are, and tries to some extent to compare QCA to other methods. And then there are also the basics of QCA for people who've never heard of it. So what's a data set looks like, and a short rundown of the steps you need to make to apply the method. Then chapter 2 is for people who really want to learn how to do it and apply it to evaluations in their kind of daily jobs. And it's a full step-by-step guide to the application of QCA. So it covers model selection, calibration, visual representation of the data, and all of four procedures to synthesize or extract information from these data sets. There are more, as Rick knows, but yes, I think four is already a good start. And then these four procedures that are covered here are called necessity analysis, sufficiency analysis, Boolean minimization, which is a form of sufficiency analysis, and INUS analysis. We'll see later what INUS means, but it's here, it's in the glossary, we have a long glossary. So in chapter in chapter 2, which is this full step-by-step guide, every step is complete with a list of opportunities offered in that particular step, like why is that step useful, but also what are the challenges and the pitfalls that you need to be aware of when you're doing that, and what are the issues at stake. And this is important for quality assurance, as we will see later. Then in chapter 3, I added this chapter 3 because there are a number of sort of critical issues that are normally raised in connection with QCA. One is generalization. Can QCA generalize? Can it not generalize? What kind of generalization does it actually do? Another one is dialogue with theory. Can we do it by it? Can we do it like alone in itself? If not, what do we combine it with? So, how do we use theory in connection with QCA, and how do we use substantive knowledge? And so, this is all very, very crucial issues. Then there's a short section on bias and a short final section on quality assurance. And then the annexes, the first annex is on causality, which I've discussed at the beginning. The second annex is about the comparison between QCA and regression analysis, which is something that statisticians or people, economists, people working in quantitative methods, ask a lot about. And then the third annex is information on the case material used that people can check to apply the procedures themselves and sort of double check that they achieve the same findings, so that the method is internally valid and they get to the same findings using the same data. The last two slides are about generalization and quality assurance. So I discussed three types of generalization, and if you're interested in this, then we can talk about it at length at the end, because I've just done a sort of a keynote at the at the conference of the method section of the German Evaluation Society, and they asked me to speak about generalization. So I talked about this at length, but just 1 hour just about generalization. Building on what I wrote for this guide, so the three types of generalization: statistical generalization, modest or contingent generalization, which I also called outside the data set and within the data set, and then conceptual generalization. And obviously you can do all three, but they're just sort of different things, so you have to kind of be mindful of the difference. Finally, the way that I've approached quality assurance is by way of a checklist. But essentially the checklist is a kind of a synthesis of the report, in that it essentially recommends use all of the four procedures that I have suggested, if not more. Use visual representations of QCA. Use at least three different software platforms. Do sensitivity tests, which I also discuss. And then for each step, take advantage of the opportunities. Do not miss any of the opportunities offered by the step. Avoid pitfalls and risks, or at least say where you haven't been able to avoid those. And then manage the challenges. So it's essentially, it's very difficult to sort of understand the quality assurance checklist without having read the report, and in particular, chapter 3.